I am Plunt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. A delightful new collection is the book from Mary Trainor, Brian Attenson, and Rick Attenson, their new book Whistle Post West, Railway Tales from British Columbia, Alberta, and Yukon, has some memorable pieces from the rich history of Western Canada had in and around, and sometimes because of, trains and the railroad. The book's tales span a century and a half of Western Canadian history, and you see how the railroad threads through history, especially when you consider the commerce that still comes across a vast expanse of land, not to mention the building out of the West from the late 19th century onwards. You meet some colorful people along the way, some scoundrels, some heroes too. It makes you nostalgic for a more civilized and less hectic way of traveling. You want to hop on a train right away and see this part of the world forthwith. I'm joined in person today by Rick and Brian Attenson. Rick's been on three times, twice for his book To Timbuktu for a Haircut, and Route 66 Still Kicks. He was vice president of Rocky Mountain Rail Tours and was CEO of both Edmonton Tourism and more recently many years as Tourism Vancouver's CEO. Brian Attenson is a veteran of broadcasting and was for a number of years the head of BCIT's broadcasting program. The Messrs. Attenson and Mary Trainor had previously co-written the best-selling Slumax Gold In Search of a Legend, which was first published in 1972 and was a huge hit. Its 2007 reissue has itself sold over 10,000 copies. Whistles Post West is published by Heritage House. Please welcome to the Plunt on Line program, Brian Attenson and Rick Attenson. Brian, good morning.
Good morning, and this is my first time. You've had three times to be honored on this, and this is my first time. So why is that?
Well, we'll fix that, won't we?
Well, thank you for having me back again.
And welcome back,
nice.
Rick. Yeah.
And I'm the last two were over the phone. So
yes,
this is nice to
it's nice to
be
meet in person. Yeah. Mary Trainor, your co-author. She's not with us today. Where does she live?
She's in
Summerland. Summerland.
And she really had a lead role on seeing this book come together. She was the liaison between the three of us and Heritage House throughout the entire manuscript development and submission and then the production. And that's an onerous job, and she was just tremendous. As you can imagine, you've got three different styles of writing that have to be somewhat aligned so that for a reader they're thinking, gee, this comes across as one voice. And Mary had a big role in that.
Mm-hmm. And she's written a lot, hasn't she, on BC?
Yeah. Mary's had a background. She was with SFU for a long time and with the what was the Greater Vancouver Regional District. And boy, she's cut her teeth on a lot of different kind of corporate writing. And then she's written books for people, commissioned books, mm-hmm. and so on. She's a very competent writer, very organized person, and cracks a mean whip. She really cracks a mean whip and keeps us going.
So whose idea was it to write about trains and railroads?
It was a collective from the three of us. We'd had a really good experience with Slumax Gold, and when you've got co-authorship, it can either be a real cock-up or it can be an enjoyable experience. And for the three of us, it was really nice to be able to share an early draft of whatever portion you were writing and get honest critique feedback. And then as it came together to be able to exchange ideas around captions, what images were going to be used. So we had found that successful for us when we did Slumax Gold together. And then we talked about, what if we did another book? And we had a number of different ideas, and we talked to Heritage House. They were keen on a book of train stories. And what the three of us wanted to do was to research some individual stories that were of interest to us. For example, Brian was quite interested in the Sunken Engine Creek story, just as one example. Billy Miner was of interest to me. Mary had some that she was quite keen on. And also Mary had met a few individuals that she thought, if we could get them to share their stories, that would enhance it. We put together an outline, offered that up to Heritage House. They had a number of really good guiding comments, came back to us, and the three of us said together, sort of over the telephone, a virtual handshake, let's mm-hmm. do this.
There are pieces in here that I kind of wish were longer and books themselves. I mean, in terms of when you write some of these pieces, you must think to yourself, I've got to keep it to a certain length because it's got to fit in this book, but maybe there's a book here. Another book, so.
Yeah, I think so. We We each knew that we had roughly a third of the wordage, and we had a rough idea of what the wordage would be. And in actual fact, it's more there's more material in there than we'd originally thought, or than Heritage House had thought. So the page numbers have expanded and things like that. But, you know, you have in mind, okay, I've got 8 or 9 stories, and I've got to produce 12 or 13,000 words. You know, you're a little over 1,000 words a story. So it's not that it's self-limiting, because you can add to one and take away from another. And a few of them were really, you know, short 400-word things. But, yeah, some of those things could be expanded into books. And not only that, but there are more stories to be told. And we have a collection of other ideas, other stories that could, in the future, go into a volume two sort of thing.
I think the longest story is maybe, what, 2,000, 2,500 words?
Something like that, yeah.
I was telling you before we started that I take the Amtrak from here to Seattle, Bellingham, Portland from time to time, a couple times a year, and I enjoy it a lot. And it's a great way to travel, especially if you're not in a hurry, because there can be delays. But in reading your book, one realizes just how important, not only for travel, but for commerce, the railroad trains were to making British Columbia. And we lose sight of that, because now we have highways and we have airplanes and the sort, and we can get around in a car. But for a lot of people, for a long time, trains were it.
They were the only way to get to unite Canada. We didn't have the freeway, the 401, the Trans-Canada. Yeah. We didn't have a way to really open up the north in British Columbia for the longest time. We had the Caribou Wagon Road and things like that, but it was trains that opened up North America.
And still the trains that keep us together in many ways. One of the things about the book Whistle Pulse West is that there's a nice balance between some of the industrial uses, the freight trains. There's the story about the silk trains and how when the silk arrived from Asia here, it had to be fast-tracked, literally, to get to the markets in the east. And yet there's also the real nice additions of just people and trains, whether it's the individual experiences that people have, because everybody's got a train story, as the book makes clear, but also, you know, transporting people. And for the longest time, that was it. That's one of the reasons that the Rocky Mountains became so famous, was as a tourist destination, because all of a sudden people could actually get there and experience them.
And trains opened up this country because they brought the immigrants who came from Europe and so on through Montreal or Toronto and brought them to the prairies, and ultimately to British Columbia.
And brought the Chinese who built the railroads, right?
Right, yeah.
Well, and that's one of the reasons that you know, today there are sixth or more generation Chinese Canadians, because their relatives came over, brought in because there was not enough labor available to be building the railway, often treated poorly, both with the work they were assigned and the danger of it, and then when the work was done, how they were almost abandoned. And
wrote them off.
Some of that is a shadow on our Canadian history. You know, look at the benefit so many years later of children who come out of that initial influx of immigrants from Asia, and it's a powerful contribution to our country.
And you just think of just the social history of it all, and what emerges in your book is this culture. Because everyone knows someone almost who's worked in and around trains, whether it's at the station or who traveled this country as an engineer, say, or even a far less prominent job on a train. It's still very much a part of who we are. I mean, resources, grains, and oil even...
They all travel by train.
To this day.
sometimes more safely than they could travel by other means or be conveyed or shipped by other means.
Well, and more efficiently.
And more efficiently, cost-effective, and quick time to market. So, trains have not just an honorable history of doing well by this country, but perhaps an equally honorable future.
Yeah, we'll talk about the future in just a sec, but reflecting on the past, there are a couple of maps at the front of the book, and you just see, as we said already, that was the only way for a lot of people to get through to different parts of this province. Are a lot of those tracks, are they still there? Are they still in use?
Oh, yeah. Look at the CP. Look at the CN.
Yeah.
Look at what is CN up to Prince George now, but was the Police Go Easy, the PGE,
yeah.
And then BC Rail. Yeah, those are and on Vancouver Island. So they're all there. Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned...
And in use.
Yeah,
and the Valley, the Fraser Valley, the interurban.
Yeah,
and Joe, you mentioned the map done by Eric Lamberger. It's a terrific map. I mean, one of the few that would be in a book that picks up not the highways, but picks up all of the railroad routes and the companies that are behind them. And some of them are no longer under those company names, but it gives an indication of where the stories can be taking place, and it shows this network of rail that. Is part service, but also part what binds us together as Western Canada. And because the book talks about Alberta and British Columbia and Yukon, the train stories are varied, and they came on at different times. So it's from the start of train traffic and railroads in Western Canada through to current days.
And as someone who uses trains as a commuter, whether it's the Amtrak, as I've mentioned, or SkyTrain even. Why isn't there more commuter service to all these places, these far-flung places in the province?
Cost.
Yeah that would be a big one.
I mean,
one.
Even just to travel on Via Rail, as we were talking earlier, to go from here to, say, Edmonton or the Rockies or even further east if you want to go to Toronto. It's just a prohibitive cost.
Well, we're quite fortunate in Western Canada to live here because we have the Rocky Mountain here and we have Via Rail as two of the world's foremost train travel experiences. Mm-hmm. And people from around the world save and plan because of the air cost of getting here, their accommodation costs, things that as residents we don't have to bear because this is part of our backyard. And so we've got lots of that train travel here. What we don't have is commuter rail travel that you would have in high population areas, and say as in Japan or certain corridors in the U.S., definitely in Europe. And to have passenger rail service here would require a substantial subsidy. So it's not going to happen. But railway experiences are plentiful here, and one of the things that we put in Whistle Post West after discussion with Heritage House, the publishers, was that we wanted to highlight a number of steam rail experiences that people can have, such as at Fort Steele or in Squamish at the West Coast Museum, where people can get out and actually today get a sense of what that was like. But if you want modern train travel, there's nowhere in the world that does it better than what Rocky Mountain here and Via Rail do.
And the museum in Squamish, is that that you can see the Royal Hudson and
yep,
all that?
The West Coast Railway Association Heritage Park.
Yeah.
Wonderful. What a wonderful visit. Huge roundhouse, and the Royal Hudson is domiciled there, and they have some wonderful train cars that have been restored. Yeah. I had dinner with the President Emeritus, Don Evans, one night. Very fortunate to do that in one of the cars. Really enjoyed it. And, of course, they've got reproductions. There's a small station that they've recreated there, and they're always rehabilitating locomotives or train cars and so on. It's a grand visit.
Yeah.
Well, and when you mention the roundhouse, you might want to talk just a little bit about Yaletown and Engine 374.
Oh, yeah, 374 is in the roundhouse. We actually, as young people, found the Royal Hudson rotting, just rusting away in the original CP roundhouse down there.
Not about found as in discovered. Other people had
found it too. But
we just tripped across it.
Yeah, tripped across it. And that got our fascination with the Royal Hudson going back in those days. But 374, the original locomotive that came across Canada, the first one, there were many others, but this was the first one that actually made it across Canada here, is preserved in Vancouver.
And that's your author photo in the book.
Yep,
it is. And that for people within Vancouver, it's an easy access point, and it can be where you begin your day, then you go about Yaletown, the seawall, whatever, and then meet back up there. So it has become a meeting point, but it's well worth spending some time there.
Yeah. It's a great old, what is known as a 440 locomotive, And that locomotive opened up the American West and the Canadian West.
Yeah. When you look back at you mentioned how it opened up the West, we think of MacDonald and how British Columbia came into Confederation in 1871. That was a promise unfulfilled.
Well, for a number of years,
yeah.
But that was the deal. And it takes time to build railroads,
yeah.
But that was the deal. If you come into to Canada, if you join us, and then we have this nation that stretches from one ocean to another, we will connect us by a railroad. And so they did.
Well,
it just took time.
Yeah. And took time to find the right routes.
The right routes, and we talk about that.
It took time to find some of the technology of the day, the engineering to be able to build when you're talking about the Fraser Canyon. Where it took a long time to get complete, of course, was on Vancouver Island. Victoria was to be the terminus, and that just didn't happen and didn't happen didn't happen. But when they were first planning to come across, they were going to be up Butte Inlet area and go across, hop on the islands like Savory and over to sort of the mid-island range and then down to Victoria. So it was a work in progress from the political point of view, from the construction point of view, and from the routing point of view.
Mm-hmm. When you think of Butte Inlet and things like that, you know, we say, well, why would you go there? But if you look back in the day, what was Vancouver? It was a few huts. What was New Westminster? A few huts. You know, so in the days when they were conceiving these things, the West Coast was just a long line of trees that met the ocean. So they could have really gone anywhere.
Well, and it came to Port Moody. It was the extension later to Vancouver, which was very frustrating for people in Port Moody who thought that they would be the western terminus, and from there it would be by ship or barge or whatever the goods needed to be conveyed to other markets or over to Vancouver Island. And the sort of business and community leaders in Port Moody of the day were quite disappointed and frustrated. And the land speculators. When this new place that got designated Vancouver changed from what we know as sort of Gastown and Hastings, mm-hmm. and early designations, it was going to then be the terminus and the port at Cole Harbour. So that changed a lot of things, and I think Brian had a really good point, undermined a lot of land speculators.
Yep.
Yeah. Digressing just a bit here. So the terminus was where the waterfront station is today, where we get the SkyTrain and the West Coast,
yep.
Express. Pacific Central, was that always there? Was that always used as, and who used that?
That was the CN station.
I see.
And
okay.
CP station was the one down at the waterfront.
I see. And yep. Then wasn't there one next to where Pacific Central, where they're building
the hospital?
There
was Great Northern.
Oh, and that's right. Sure. Great Northern was in there, of course. Yeah.
It disappeared, sadly, during the days before Vancouver got its act together about protecting our vanishing heritage,
yeah.
and which, of course, we're seeing now in the issues around housing and some
yeah.
of the remarkable
yeah.
homes that were built long ago,
yeah.
And you know, when you see part of the cultural heritage dissembling, you think of the buildings that we could have preserved,
mm-hmm.
and Vancouver didn't have as many old buildings as, say, a Toronto or an Ottawa or some of the American cities, so that we keep that cityscape. Now it's being done more thoughtfully, that you don't have to throw out everything about an old building. You can keep the facade or keep some of it so you've got the street character. And that building, had it have been preserved, would have had lots of functionality around it,
mm-hmm.
but it disappeared, and in part a lack of thought and protection that we could have done.
So that's
the Great Northern. It
yes.
disappeared.
So that's next to where Pacific Central is now. It's an empty
Correct.
Lot. That's where they're saying they're going to build the hospital,
that's
I guess,
one of
right?
the discussion
yeah.
points. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's been empty for so long, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, as long as I've known it. Brian, as I said, I ride the Amtrak, and it goes from Pacific Central east before it heads south.
Yep.
And so one of the places where it passes is around Burnaby Lake.
Yeah.
And there are legends surrounding that
yeah.
place.
Yeah. Yeah, that has fascinated me for a long time. And so when it came time to throw up some ideas for stories and so on, I threw out the Sunken Engine story. And then found in all of the research work, and I was talking to various people and looking at old newspaper articles and things like that, that it probably wasn't north of Burnaby Lake. It was probably actually west of Burnaby Lake by a mile or two where this occurred. What twigged me to that, I mean, it's all bogland through there.
Yeah.
So there's huge infrastructure now, and there's highways and all those different things, but they've had to deal with peat bogs. So if you imagine back at the turn of the century when they would put the railway through, they were dealing with peat bogs as well. So the concept is not really hard to embrace, the fact that the track just suddenly disappears and an engine sank down there in some way. But what really fascinated me is I'm doing my research and I'm all over the internet and so on, and I stumble upon this map, and it's an official Burnaby Waterways map. And I've been aware of Burnaby Waterways forever, but I also worked with a fellow named Mark Angelo at BCIT, and Mark is the guy who was part of the team that saved Still Creek and all of the different waterways that flow into there. So I've been aware of the fact that that whole trough has all these feeder streams. And I'm looking at this map one day, and I looked just a little west of Burnaby Lake, and there's a little tiny stream called Sunken Engine Creek. And that nailed it for me. I thought, well, there is a creek that was named in honor of this event. So a little more research, and yeah, that's why it was named that way.
So when would this have been, the turn of the century?
Well, it depends on who you believe.
Pick 19, a year.
1906, yeah. 1906, 1910, and 1912 are the 3 years that are most popularly named as when. But that's quite a span.
You know,
so nobody knows for sure.
And nobody saw it. Happen.
Well, there's a fellow named Nathaniel, but Nap for short, Nap Peltier, who was interviewed in 1959, and he said that he was one of the crew.
Mm.
He was one of the guys, and they just went off for lunch, and when they came back, the track was gone, the locomotive and the train was gone. And it was a train of probably half a dozen cars full of gravel, because they'd had this sinkhole there, and so they were trying to fill that up and so on. And so they went away, came back, and there was nothing but bubbles coming up from the bog. Fascinating story. It's locally known. It's also been in some national or I should say U.S.-based magazines as a story.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of material out there.
Though, you know, when Brian says it's locally known, one of the things about the book Whistlepost West is that things that perhaps yourself as someone interested in trains, or Mary, trainer Brian, myself, and some of the people that we were interviewing and researching with, it's known, but it's not widely known. And mm-hmm. I would venture that of the hopefully thousands of people who read Whistlepost West, that this will be news for 99% of them.
Yeah,
some of the other stories, Krigaliki, the last spike, our version on it talks about there are actually four last spikes that day. And what we tell it through is about the young fellow, the teenager, who is in the photograph. So we get into a lot of things like that we think readers will be saying, I did not know that. Or I knew a little bit, but I did not know the rest of the story. And I think a really good example is Sunken Engine Creek, that people might have heard about it, but once they've read this story, it'll be dinner conversation for a lot of people.
Yeah, there have been books written about Billy Miner, for example.
Yes, there have been.
You bet.
And yet, when you introduce us to him to him in this book, again, a lot of people may not know him. They may know him from that dessert you can get at the Keg, I guess, that they made after him.
Billy Miner
Mud Pie. Yeah.
Well, 1904, and Billy Miner was here. He had worked his way here from throughout the United States, where he was pretty good at robbing stagecoaches and spending a lot of time in jail. No fixed address, but his longest stays in most communities were behind bars. And then as trains become more popular, he adapts and starts holding up trains. And he is credited with coining the phrase. He was credited by Pinkerton's with coining the phrase, hands up. And that was how he greeted people. And he also became known, which was carried through into a movie called The Gray Fox, became known as the Gentleman Bandit. And it was because of his demeanor, a bit of his attire, his bearing. He was
always very polite.
Very polite. Well said. he was courteous. And yet when you've got two guns pointing at you, you could easily overlook the person's demeanor. And so it was Canada's second train robbery, but the first in Western Canada in 1904, out Silverdale Mission area, to just give listeners an indication of the rough area. And among the taking away were paper currency, not cash, bonds that have not been found, not cashed, and not traced. And the thought is, and this is an area, Maple Ridge, Meadows, think of that area in people's minds. And somewhere out there, he may well have cashed this. That was a load of money in those days, to return at a later point after he had escaped and gone off and everything had cooled down. And unfortunately, they got arrested and one thing led to another. But the thought is, this was never found and is still there to be found. And one of the things we pose in the story is that, some hiker someday, because there are lots of trails out there, or somebody close to a new housing development that's clearing land, that's close to the railway tracks, is going to say, wow, look at that.
What is this?
That's Billy Miner's lost loot.
Mm-hmm. It's as I mentioned earlier, this culture that evolves around trains and the lingo of it. There's certain terms and words and phrases.
And they're recounted.
Gandy dancers.
Yeah.
What's that?
Well, a gandy dancer, if I recall now, we did some research on this because one of our advisors, a guy who very, very knowledgeable railroad guy, was not familiar with that term himself. And so we thought, well, maybe it shouldn't be included, but we would like to research and find out more.
Yeah.
We found out a number of people who actually have knowledge of this and so on, and people who say, well, my father was a gandy dancer. These were the people who moved the ties along. So as the rails were moving, as a track was being laid, and they put down the roadbed, and then they had to put down the ties, and then along come the rails and so on. So gandy dancers was the people who were working ahead, as we understand it, working ahead of the rail coming and laying down the ties and so on. A term that's in use throughout North America about one of the jobs in laying a railroad track.
And so quickly forgotten.
Yeah.
Well, and so many other terms, particularly if you're not in the railway community. And though the lingo of one geographic area, say part of the states or one particular railroad, and a lot of those were short lines, they didn't last for that long, but they picked up or made or adapted things that they would say themselves. So we do have a section in Whistle Pulse West where we talk about talk and train talk, and there's just one here that says a fire boy was an apprentice to a fireman hoping to earn the more senior designation of a bakehead. So you get these, and the shovel they used, the lifter, was called a banjo. And if the coal went, missed the doorway, because you're rocking along on the railway, they were said to spill the diamond. So there were lots of phrases like that. And we talked about this. This is another thing with Mary and Brian and myself. We thought, gee, we're coming across all these neat phrases. And maybe it'd be kind of fun to share them. But how do you do that? You don't just put an index at the back of the book that says,
or
you
footnote
look these up
or
footnotes.
Yeah.
So we ended up with this section that goes through for a few pages. That's just the idiosyncratic names, designations, things that real railroad workers, not people like Brian and yourself and myself or Mary who love trains, but people who actually made their day-to-day living working on the railroads.
Yeah.
And this is how they talk to one another.
Yeah. Let's talk about the future. And trains will remain. I mean, when they're talking about pipelines and the sort, they still talk about trains being a viable option for transport. Technology has improved it a great deal, hasn't it? You think of Lac-Mégantic, for example, which is, I would think, probably more human error than anything else.
It was a combination of several errors,
But 30, 40, 50 years down the line, we'll still have trains?
Oh, without a doubt. And like you talk about technology. Well, they're doing different things now. They're mandating that new tank cars, and they're going to replace the old cars and so on. So they'll be at least double skinned or double hulled. It's like freighters today, oil tankers and so on. They're not just a piece of plate steel and then oil.
Mm-hmm.
There's two and three layers and air spaces and so on. So we've reduced, because we've had some really bad experiences, we've reduced the possibility of tanker collisions and tanker oil spills and things like that. They still happen, but we've used technology to reduce the incidents, and we've become much more safe. Well, same thing's happening with railroads. So if you're going to transport flammable materials or really anything that can damage the environment and so on, you've got to have a better way of encasing it and keeping it in place. Train wrecks happen. We do lose track beds for they get washed out. People drive a car across and then the train hits it and there's a wreck. We can't control those things. Mm-hmm. But what you can try to control is what happens as a result of the collision. Do we contain the chlorine or does it spill into a creek? Do we contain the oil or the gas or does it spill into a creek? And so that's where technology is going.
Though another area that technology is contributing in trains is indeed for passenger service and making it more not just fuel efficient but cost effective for individuals who want to travel. So it's long been talked about, would there be a speedy train between Edmonton and Calgary, for example? What about the Vancouver-Seattle-Portland corridor? And there are other high concentration areas, high activity areas that in North America that may be used for that. But passenger travel, when you look at what's being done in Spain or what's being done in France, you look at some of the innovation that's happening in the UK.
Japan
is phenomenal. Shinkansen is just a beautiful experience. Or in China, in Shanghai, you know, you can go out to the airport and you're going 300K. It's an amazing experience. Yeah. And your drink isn't rocking.
Yeah,
it's as smooth as can be.
Your ears are popping.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. None of that. You can be reading it, and it's quiet. So with that, and when you look at for example, a country like China that is doing so much in the way of railroad and highway infrastructure, they need to be at the leading edge of construction, innovation, and safety. The ridership demands that. The communities, as Brian was talking about, some of the commercial uses and flammable fuels, all of those dangerous cargo things, the communities demand that the latest in technology absolutely minimizes the opportunity for there to be a disaster.
And there's a side impact that not a lot of people think about, but rails being much more efficient is one thing. You can carry a lot of people on one train. And so the commuter impact here is demonstrable. I live in Mission. I worked for years in New Westminster or in Burnaby. And so I was a commuter. Mm-hmm. Every day I was in and out. And over decades, I watched the number of cars in front of me increase and the length of time it took for my trip increase dramatically. And then along came the West Coast Express. And it starts in Mission, and it picks up people all the way in. Well, it reduces the number of cars on the highway, and you say, okay, well, my commute now has gone back to a more manageable length of time. But also pollution has been reduced. You've got one train, diesel, and actually there's, I think, six departures. But one train with diesel effluent, if you will, coming out versus thousands of cars. And so we're always going to have pollution. We live in a modern age where we generate that. But if we can reduce the amount by putting people on trains, wonderful.
Yeah. Well, and that has, of course, been the impetus for SkyTrain.
Yep.
The rationale that in the Metro Vancouver area, you have a choice. You can either move cars or you can move people. And the more sound approach is to find ways to move people. And when you think of the need for a rapid transit that links sort of the downtown area or the Broadway corridor out to UBC, mm-hmm. through all of that medical research, medical service area, what Mike Harcourt has called the brain train. And when you think of what is needed out in
in Surrey, perhaps a bit surface-oriented or maybe elevated and linking out to Langley. When you think of where we could be by the year 250, and if we want to be there with an absolute, you can get anywhere, work in any neighborhood, and you can have work either close, but if you do need to commute, you can do it in an environmentally responsible way. We need a drastic expansion of train-related transportation under the designation of SkyTrain.
Look at London.
Absolutely.
The underground, the tube.
Yeah.
You can get anywhere you want in London in a very few minutes, and we're working toward that. We're a much younger city, our metropolitan area, but they wrote the book on mass transit.
And people are there. People want to get there. People would rather take a train than, say, drive.
Yeah. If it's reliable and it's safe and it's comfortable and it's clean, but not every city gets that. If you look at what Vancouver has done, say, since Expo, and what it's on the brink of doing with the Evergreen Line and the other pieces of that are on the drawing board, and you compare that with Seattle, two cities with metro populations, you know, about to exceed 2 million, and on their way to, in this whole Cascadia corridor, double up and triple up over time, and we're restricted by water access, we're water on a barrier, we've got the border, we've got the mountains, we've got agricultural land that we're protecting. And so if you're going to move people and have population increases, they're going to need to be concentrated. And they can concentrate around, as we're seeing, where there are transport hubs, and those are SkyTrain stations. But you look at Vancouver, which got it, needs to get it better, and Seattle, which actually pioneered at the World's Fair in the 60s, the whole notion of sky rail, and they just totally missed the opportunity to build on it.
You mentioned Expo. Expo 86 started as Transpo 86. And in fact, the fellow who was instrumental in the moving that forward, Patrick Reed, just died this in the last few days at the age of 91. Transpo 86 morphed into Expo 86, but the transportation focus was still there. And Steam Expo was a huge success. The first, was it 6 weeks, I think, or maybe longer, of Expo 86 had Steam Expo down in those lands that are now, there's Longna Quaid and there's a bunch of car dealerships and so on. There must have been, what would you say?
The Steam Expo?
Yeah, how many engines?
Dozens
of engines. Some very, very replicas of the very first engines, and then some of the most...
restored.
Restored. And then some of the more recent, you know, the big boys and so on. Now, I shouldn't have said that. Big boy is a specific engine. I meant the big boys, you know, the larger steam engines and so on. It was, I was down there a dozen times anyway. Yeah. Wonderful experience.
Well, and in and around all of that, Harry Holm and Pat Crowley had the idea that passengers should be able to travel through the Rockies by daylight. And they came up with the concept of a two-day rail tour between Alberta and British Columbia that would have overnighting in Kamloops. And they took this idea, which they did a one run of, and broached it with the federal government, with the railways. And it ended up being something that and we write about this in here, it ended up being something that Via Rail undertook. Pat and Harry... rightly got sidetracked, and they talked candidly about that frustration. And then within a couple of years, that service was privatized by the federal government and was purchased by a company that is now known as Rocky Mountaineer, and it's become probably the most spectacular train trip in the world. Yet it all goes back to in around Expo 86. Mm-hmm. And so we do tell the story under the Mountaineer about in the early 1900s, how the name the Mountaineer was in fact the train out of Chicago that made its way west, and how all of that developed over time, and what we have today is a recognition of Western Canada as a center for any traveler from around the world. It is like their version of train travel mecca. They want to get here and ride one of the great train trips.
Yeah, it's something that, as you said, it's in our backyard and we ought to do.
Well, you know, and this is maybe an odd thing for the former CEO of Tourism Vancouver to say, but one of the main reasons people visit Vancouver is to leave us, because we've got the world's best backyard, and that's called British Columbia and Alberta and Yukon.
Yeah, and there are efforts. We talked about the museum in Squamish for railway preservation and museums and the sort throughout the province, right?
Yes.
You can go to almost any
part of Alberta or British Columbia, Yukon, where you can see a real sense of the history of trains. There's less about the modern thrust, but if your fascination is the romance of steam trains, the old whistle sounds, the sense of almost better days, the development of Western Canada, it's able to be found in community museums, in mini centers, and again in the book Whistle Pulse West, there's contact information for all of those places, and there are many photographs that encourage people to get out and enjoy that. Get on a train.
You can experience a train robbery in British Columbia today. There's a couple of different operations.
And in Alberta as well,
where you're out there, you're riding this old train behind an old locomotive, and all of a sudden there's cowboys coming out of nowhere, and they're all masked, and they're, you know, they're riding the horses, and they're shooting their guns, and they get on, and they rob you, and they want your change. And, of course, it all goes to charity and stuff like that. But you can experience a real train robbery, and people pay good money to do that.
Billy Miner would have had a career.
If only he'd known.
This past weekend, I was at a used bookstore, Pulp Fiction, on Broadway in Maine, and I picked up this book, Slumax Gold. And I'd never read it, and so that's why I bought it. Heard lots of things about this over the years. This was a big hit, as I mentioned.
Huge.
Off the top. Yeah.
And well, thank you for buying it.
This is the book that I guess this was the is this how you first met Mary?
It goes back.
Well,
to
actually, before that, when I was in second year at BCIT in the broadcasting program, Mary was in first year. So I knew her, and then she subsequently worked with Rick, and she put the name together, and so the three of us got together. We had a common interest in writing about history and BC stuff and so on.
And we started out looking at this. Brian and I actually first heard about Slumex Gold when we were out. How old?
Well, I was nine. You were eight.
Okay, yeah. So we were up at Hatsik Lake at a camp, and an old fisher's wife around a campfire told us the story about there's gold, but you'll not find it and live. So we heard about the curse, about the early murder, and about the dozens of people who have gone up Pitt Lake area, lower Pitt Lake, somewhere around Pitt Lake, northern Pitt Lake, looking for the lost gold mine that tracks back to the late 1800s and a native fellow indigenous Slumac. And so that story we hung with, and out of some sort of side conversations, the three of us decided that we would research this further, write a book about it, because we were interested in BC history. This is around, you know, 71, and there British Columbia is celebrating 100 years
Centennial,
of Confederation. Yeah. So lots was happening. It was early days in the publishing industry in BC, and we produced a 64-page saddle-stitched book that told this story. We also met a fellow who's now a really good friend, Don Waite, who at the same time was writing and self-publishing a book about Slumac, and we became friends. Our books actually got combined, and we write about Don in this, and we actually did a book signing recently because he's just done a really, really good book, also published by Heritage House, on gold hunters of British Columbia and Yukon. So those were early days, but we worked together on it through that, ended up meeting Bill Barley, who was a real motivator for us, and of course he went on to be Minister of Tourism for British Columbia, but I don't think anybody has done the job that Bill did on telling history, both on television,
Gold
and
Creek,
his radio
Ghost
programs.
Towns, all those different.
Canada
West.
Everybody's grown up with those in this part of the world, right? Watching that. This book, Whistle Post West, made me awfully nostalgic reading it, and it makes me want to get on a train. And you do that frequently, both of you, do you?
Not as frequently as I'd like. Last time I was on a train was Beyond SkyTrain.
Yeah.
Was in England a couple of years ago and took the train from London to Edinburgh and then from Edinburgh back to London and so on. So I've traveled a fair amount in Britain on what was Brit Rail and their British system.
Yeah.
And so on. I'd like to travel more.
I've been really fortunate to travel a lot by train. My wife, Janice, lives in Australia, and I'm there a lot. And we just recently rode the GAN from Adelaide to Darwin. And a year ago, we took the Indian Pacific from Perth across to Sydney, which was great. Traveled a lot with my two sons, Brent and Sean, over the years, over about five different trips. We ended up circumnavigating the Northern Hemisphere by train. That includes across Siberia and Mongolia and places like Belarus, North Korea, coming into China from the east. So a lot, and I've traveled train in Africa a number of times, and it's there's something amazing about it. Paul Thoreau said that train travel is that last word in truth serum, and part of that is maybe that it just comes out different than if you're sitting next to somebody on an airplane for a few hours. If you've got a couple of days on a train, you kind of get telling your story. So our encouragement through Whistle Post West is that people have this latent interest in trains. Revive it.
Yeah.
Get out. Get on a train and get to some of the museums around BC, Alberta, and Yukon. See and experience it. Get that smell of it, because it's real. The nostalgia is palpable.
Yeah, and you not only know each other better, you know yourself better in the journey, and you know this place better.
Yeah.
Whether it's British Columbia or wherever you're going. And you've done, both of you and Mary, a great service in terms of showcasing that which we need to remember and what's possible.
Thank you.
And it's a pleasure to meet both of you. Known of both of you for over the years. Talked to you, Rick, and known of you, Brian. Thanks for coming in to do this. I really appreciate it. And congratulations on this book. I understand it's selling well. And continue good luck with it.
On the bestsellers list, which
and we're
really
thrilled
exciting.
With that. Yeah, yeah, very exciting, and we think it's a great gift, a great present, be it a Christmas gift or a birthday gift or something like that. It's a wonderful thing. It's timely, it's interesting, and who knows where it will lead to other projects, other ideas, and so on.
Yeah, well, let's hope that other people will want to get on a train.
Well, that's really encouraging. You know, that's a strong motivation for us to share the stories. Publishers love book sales. Writers want readers. And so to have people spending time around a fire or in their front rooms or in a park after a walk or in a coffee house reading Whistle Pulse West really is that's the reward for Mary and for Brian and myself.
Thanks for this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The book is called Whistle Post West, Railway Tales from British Columbia, Alberta, and Yukon. It's published by Heritage House. Two of its co-authors, Brian Antonsen and Rick Antonsen, join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.